Yo, what is a cipher?
It's very awe-inspiring indeed.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sitaro. This week, we bring back someone we haven't seen in a very long time, Skyzu. Sky was one of our first guests a little over 3 years ago. On that episode, we learned all about how he came up in Bed-Stuy and began his career as one of the sharpest MCs in the game. But a lot has happened since then, and we wanted to bring Skyzu back to talk about it. He's released three superb projects. There was the mixtape An Ode to Reasonable Doubt, an updating of and tribute to the Jay-Z classic. There was his collaboration with longtime friend Torre as the Barrel Brothers. And most importantly, there's his newest album, Music for My Friends. That record continues Skyzu's tradition of smart, powerful music that tells honest, engaging stories about his life and experiences. As if that wasn't enough, he's even spent time ghostwriting songs for other artists, a fact he slyly alludes to on his new song, Luxury. We met up with Skyzu at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. If you enjoy The Cipher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for instance, you need to check out Skyzu's first appearance on the show on episode 18. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com. And now, here's Casper the Friendly writing for the Forbes list, Skyzu. The last time I had you here was like fall of 2012.
Yeah, I guess.
It was like right around A Dream Deferred, I think, even.
Yeah.
Is that right?
2012, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Talked about all the you know, mixtapes leading up to that and all the album stuff. What I didn't know, somehow, your early career was the thing on Freestyle Fridays on 106 and Park. Somehow you neglected to mention.
This was so long ago. I even forget about it.
But it's great. So, you know, you battled Jim.
Let's be real. How you think you gonna see me? My girl look like free. Yours look like freeway. Oh, get it right. You think I won't smoke ya? I had your mama putting up Skyzu posters. I spit like Sam Cassell face. Ugly and battle any chump who thinks she wanna touch me. Who you try to diss, man? He masturbates so much he had to rock a wristband. You got guns, point him away. He's so played out, I thought he was the old school joint of the day. I got fans across the country, Jin is who they feeling. Last time he had a fan, it was spinning on the ceiling.
You were on there that one time?
Yeah, I just did the one time. Yeah, it was Freestyle Friday. This is 2002, so this is when Freestyle Friday would get you a record deal. This is when, like, labels were glued to Freestyle Friday. Friday afternoon, evening, whatever it was, and 106 came on, labels would stop what they was doing and just watch Freestyle Friday. This is like right after Poster Boy and all that stuff. So this was like, it was nuts. I remember the audition, the line was wrapped around the block like twice. It literally was on 106 and Park. It was the address just like the show.
Yeah.
And the auditions were there and the line was wrapped around the block twice. I remember Jen being there because he was the only, you know, Asian kid out there. So he was there. You know, he stood out for sure. Fred the Godson was there. He wound up being on the show at one point. I think Hell-Rell might have been there that day, but I know he wound up being on the show at some point. There's a lot of people who were on the show and, you know, it kind of gets forgotten about or whatever, which is cool because it was so long ago.
Right.
But mine always sticks out because of what happened, you know, because of, you know, what I did in the battle and all that. But yeah, it was a good time, man. It was cool.
Who ended up winning that?
Oh, well, Jen won. You know, he did the 7 weeks and they retired him and all that. So I think I was week five. I remember, like, right after the battle, he was like, dude, that was the wildest battle I've ever been in. He was like, yo, that was serious. Like, that could have really went either way. Like, I wouldn't have been surprised.
Do you think he got you or?
No, not at all. you know, but, and we've talked about it since. And Jen is the homie, you know, mad cool, shows love. It's funny that you mentioned that, you know, that I recently was sitting at the computer and I found all these old pictures from when I was on tour. in China, Hong Kong, and Beijing. And I found all these pictures of me and Jen. You know, we had ran into each other in the street. I ran into Jen, and he was like, dude, what are you doing in Hong Kong? And I was like, I'm out here on tour. He was like, oh, my God, that's crazy. Like, I ran into you in Hong Kong, of all places. And he came to the show, and we hung out, and we drunk, like, Asian cognac and all that in the spot. And it was awesome. You know, we got a bunch of pictures, and we were just bugging out. And the love and the respect is definitely mutual. But, yeah, that day, it was crazy, man. Mine always gets remembered, man. There's a lot of people who was on Freestyle Friday who, you know, it gets forgotten about. But mine always gets remembered just because of how close it was as far as, like, yo, that could have went either way. Yo, that was the only person to really go there with Jen. Yeah. I mean, he said himself time and time again, like, Sky was the only person where it was like, wow. That could have went another way, you know. So it was a good time, you know. Yeah. It was good, and I was 19. I was young. I was running around, throwbacks on, and it was a good time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. And talking about that reminds me of something else about you that I don't think I knew it when we talked a couple of years ago, which is like when you do freestyles, like radio freestyles and stuff, you'll always improvise.
Okay, Tron sees only, I chew to be holy. Ooh. And you get on your knees, you pray holy. The water that I'm throwing is Hennessy drenched. So when I get to me in mind, you sit on the bench. And therefore, when it come to the way that I pen, come to the way that I'm in, come to the beats laid and the loops laid that I bend. I'm there if it's needed.
100%.
You'll always go off the top, which, yep, as you know, is something not a ton of people do.
At all. Maybe a handful, maybe five. Maybe you can count on one hand, you know, yeah, what I mean?
Yeah. What, why do you do that?
To show the spirit, to show how I grew up as an MC when I first started, and to show lyrical exercise. For me, it's like playing pickup basketball. Freestyling off the top of the head is like playing pickup basketball in the park. If you're in the NBA, you know, you're Melo or Steph Curry or whatever, but you still go to the park and play pickup, or you still go to the gym every day and just shoot and work on your game by yourself. To me, that's the equivalent of spitting off the top. So I use those opportunities to really go for it. You know, and anytime I would hear the word freestyle as a kid, I would assume people would really freestyle. And right, a lot of times back in those days, late 80s, early 90s, mid 90s, they were. Yeah. You know, they were freestyling. It didn't get into the point where maybe mid, late 90s, where it became really scrutinized as far as how dope you were when it was freestyle. And really the mixtape scene, which we all love, you know, the Clue era and all that stuff.
But then you could hear people doing the same freestyles on, right, multiple radio shows.
Right,
or
spitting stuff off their album. Yeah. You know what I mean? You'll hear somebody on the radio getting busy and their album dropped tomorrow. So they would go on, you know, Clue Monday night mixtape show or, you know, whatever it was, K-Slay show, whatever. And, you know, they would spit a stupid verse. Then you bought the album the next day and you heard that verse on track 5. And you were like, oh, man, I know the verse already, but I just heard it out, you know? So I think the mixtape era, because it was, you know, new so-and-so freestyle, new so-and-so freestyle. And the freestyles were so crazy because, you know, it'd be an instrumental and whoever would write their verse and kill it. And it was a recorded freestyle. It wasn't like a radio thing, but it raised the bar. So I think when it came down to radio freestyles and cypher freestyles, everybody was like, well, I got to have 5 verses on deck. Because I think those mixtape eras that we all love really raised the bar for that. When you heard the Locks going crazy on, you know, Primo beats.
Locks drop shit that make niggas mob shit. You wanna pop shit, nigga, pop clips.
Too many niggas shaky, life is shaky. I act like this, cause they make me, probably hate me, nigga. I'm in a dictionary, look me up, express art from my heart. Baby, cook me up, I'm the crack in your
tape. Whatever beat was hot at the time, and when you heard Mace going crazy, you know, on all these Clue tapes.
We at the car show where all the stars go. In the Jacob Javits, girls laced with carrots. Here, honey, blind and shade by astonished. Real foxy mama used to rock the bonnet from neck to floor like no girl you met before. How does Ecuador make you want to sex a roar?
It raised the bar, and yeah, it made people say the word freestyle just means a stupid, stupid verse, whether it's written or not, you know. Yeah. But for me, if I'm on the radio, I'm going off the top.
Yeah. And when you're doing that, you know, we've talked to a couple people on the show who have been really involved in the freestyle scene or in battle, yeah, scenes, you know, people like Blueprint and like that. Yeah. Who were fully in that scene for a while. And I'm always fascinated by, like, when you're in that moment, like, what kind of stuff are you thinking about? Like, how far ahead are you thinking? Do you, like, a word pops into your head and you, like, sort of have to get to a rhyme with it? Like, what kind of stuff are you thinking about? Yeah, when you're actually freestyling.
For me, I think it's the first thing that comes to mind. You know, it's, you have to train yourself, because you have to train yourself to where no matter what you're talking about, somehow making it rhyme on the fly within a matter of seconds. You might have 3 seconds to make something rhyme.
Right, or people are gonna forget sense. About the word or
right.
whatever.
Right, yeah. It has to rhyme and it has to make sense. So if I were to sit here and freestyle this whole interview, I don't have time to think about, oh, you know, how can I make it rhyme? I've got to make it make sense. So the fact that it rhymes has to be second nature. It has to be like breathing. The make it rhyme factor has to be second nature, and the focus has to be on making it make sense. And that all comes from practice and over time and all that. I mean, I've been rhyming since I was 9 years old. So at this point, it is like breathing almost.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to talk about Music For My Friends, your most recent album.
Mm-hmm.
It's unusual because, you know, like a lot of your projects, it has a concept, you know, it has sort of a idea behind it, a unifying right. idea. But unlike a lot of concept albums, it's not a narrative.
Right.
You can't say, well, one day he went out with his friends and then this
right,
happened.
Right.
It's not like a Good Kid, Mad City or something
right.
in a sense that there's
right.
a straight narrative. Why did you go that route, the kind of more abstract concept route? Were you ever tempted to like make it a narrative, like a day in the life kind of thing?
No, I never wanted to do that for two reasons. One, I didn't want people thinking Kendrick. Oh, he tried to do what Kendrick did, you know, like, nah, you know, I wouldn't want people thinking that. And two, I've never been the narrative guy per se when it came to storytelling. I always said there were two types of storytellers. You got your Nas type of storyteller where it's narrative, you know, he talks about turning, well, he's a gun.
I seen some cold nights and bloody days. They grabbed me and bullet spray. They used me wrong, so I sing this song to this day. My body is cold steel for real. I was made to kill. That's why they keep me concealed under car seats.
Or he tells a story where this guy woke up this day and he went out and he got shot and, you know, he drove off in the Benz while he had a bullet in his leg and he kept going and he ran into his baby mother and she picked him up. And, you know, it would always be person, place, thing, who, what, when, where, why, whatever, which is great. And then you had your Jay-Z storytellers, where people don't really look at Jay-Z as a storyteller when they look at the landscape of his career, but he definitely was. You know, if you listen to Reasonable Doubt, if you listen to even records like Hard Knock Life, which was a huge radio record, even though it was slow and kind of unorthodox for a radio record, it was a huge radio record, but he was telling a story.
I went from lukewarm to hot, sleeping on futons and cots, the king size, green machines, the green fives, the scene pies, let the thing between my eyes analyze life's ills. Then I put it down tight grill. I'm tight grill.
You know, all these records throughout his career, he was a storyteller, but he doesn't get looked at that way because there never was a narrative on some A to Z and everything in between in one setting. There was never who, what, when, where, why. He just spoke about all these moments and events that happened in his life because he was just retelling and reflecting and recalling. And I've always been a little more of that type of storyteller. I've had those moments in my career, especially in the early days, where I would come up with a creative story. You know, I got a record I did in 2004 called True Romance, which is a super hard record to find. I think it's only like a YouTube thing, but super hard record to find back in my demo days, 03, 04, where it's literally about a couple and, you know, somebody dying and the other one being there for them and somebody getting shot and da-da-da-da-da. It's a whole thing.
Late night, Marcus kidnapped one of the guards and snuck past the security margin. Dressed like a CO, he met heaven in the next town with a rental car. But little did he know, word spread fast that an inmate dashed. The pigs from all over was plotting on his ass. Cop cars flying at 110 speed, tipped off by a gas station attendee.
You'd have to go find it. I don't even have it. I think it's on YouTube, though. But once in a while, I'll get a tweet where somebody's like, yo, True Romance is the greatest rap story I've ever heard. You know, so I've had those moments in my career. But being able to broaden the amount of people who can hear the records and the listeners' attention, I didn't want to go super narrative later on throughout. I just wanted to really tell stories that reflected and recalled what I went through as far as the moments.
Yeah.
As opposed to let's just tell one story. I just wanted to speak on everything as a whole. In stories and in parts and pieces, you know. So getting back to Music For My Friends throughout all that, I really just wanted to speak about the idea of a moment or an era where when you're a kid, here's the theme behind Music For My Friends, in case you may or may not know, and Sean, you probably knew, but Music For My Friends is about being 13, 14 years old and how you grow up and the people and things around you that influence you. Because I feel like the things that happen to you or happen around you when you're that age impacts you forever. I feel like that's the most critical point, being 13, 14, just becoming a teenager. Your body's changing. You know, your voice is changing. you're getting these ideas as an adult, you're interested in the opposite sex, you know, you're becoming all these different things. So you're almost like an adult. You're on your way to that point. But at the same time, you still got a curfew and you still wake up in the morning and eat cereal and watch cartoons and you still got to write a Christmas list for your parents. So it's kind of, you're caught in between this world. It's this yin and this yang, this left and right that you're caught in the middle of. So whatever you see and whatever you're influenced by, whatever's around you, is going to push you in a certain direction for the rest of your life. Whoever you grow up around, whatever conditions you're in, it's going to push you forever. This album is about what my friends and I saw when we were 13, 14 years old and how that shaped us however many years later in 2015. That's really what the album is about.
Yeah. Your voice on the album is really interesting because you're talking about all these things that you and your friends experienced or more to the point, your mind states
right.
when you were
absolutely
a teenager, but you're kind of looking back on it as an adult. And
exactly.
at the same time, every once in a while, you'll kind of, a line will pop out and say, I know I'm telling this story in a dope way.
Right.
It gets lighter than a fly knit, tighter than an eye slit, brighter than a writer you was bright enough to climb with, complimenting you while bigging up me, just bring us up to speed to the steps that we align with, then it all ties in.
Sort of commenting on like, hey, I'm rapping on this and,
right.
you know. Can you talk a bit about like the point of view that the album's coming from?
Yeah, it's nowadays, you know, it's me as an adult kind of explaining why we see the world the way we do. So if you look at my friends, the reason why they prioritize certain things in their lives, the reason why I prioritize certain things in my life, or the reason why I look at things in a certain manner now is because of what we saw when we were that age. You know, I'm the kid who always explains in his music where I grew up, you know, in certain neighborhoods in Brooklyn and later on Southside, Queens, and there's nothing I haven't seen. But at the same time, that was all outside. And then when I would go inside the house, which was right next door to my other friends, we had black art on the wall. And, you know, I had my pops. You know, a lot of my friends didn't have a father. Most of them didn't. It may have been one or two other fathers across the street or down the block, but that was it. It was like an episode of Everybody Hates Chris. You know, it was like the only few fathers on the block and they all knew each other, you know? So I had my father and I had, you know, the opportunity to go to schools in other neighborhoods. You know, I never went to high school or junior high school in my borough. I always went to school in Manhattan. You know, I always went to schools where you had to take a test to get in and you had to do this and do that. It was, you know, those types of things. And I was always AP English and all that. So even though my friends and I grew up in the same everything and when we were outside, we saw it all at the same time. I was able to see a little bit more on top of that because of having both my parents and because of, you know, going to school in different neighborhoods. So here's where that comes into play as far as this juxtaposition and these different conflicts and what makes my friends and I still attached at the hip, you know. So it's all this, we're the same, but then we're different, but then we're still the same. And that's all, you know, what it all comes down to on that album.
Yeah. And, you know, I was looking at a documentary that you put together for the album, which is great for people who haven't seen it. You know, we'll link to it on the show page.
Thank you. Appreciate
it. It's about 24, 25 minutes of like, you know, not just some like slapdash, you know, documentary in quotes.
Right.
Like it's actually, you know, you meet the people you talk about on the album,
right.
your real life friends. But there was a moment in there I wanted to ask about, which is you see you in the studio with Saba, coaching her through her vocal part on her song.
You can tell my cigarette. I like it when we get high. The way we go deeper. Nothing else matters more.
And that got me wondering, like, how involved are you on the actual, like, vocal melodies and the singing on your records?
Oh, everything. Everything. I'm hands-on. Because I'm a hands-on person with anything that I'm creating because I believe if I let somebody else handle it and it goes wrong, then I'm blaming them forever. But if I handle it and it goes wrong, then cool, it's my fault and I got to live with that. But at least I know it was executed the way I wanted. But if I leave it up to somebody else, it's like, dag, that went wrong. And it might have went right if I handled it and was executed the way I wanted, you know?
Yeah.
If it goes wrong, then I can live with that. But if it goes wrong because of somebody else, I can't live with that. So, plus, you know, I just love the creative process. I love, you know, putting the music together. And I love being behind the scenes, kind of Quincy Jones-ish, just as much as I love being in front, Michael Jackson-ish, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a mixture of the two, you know? It's me loving the process of making music. So, you know, me in there with a Saba or with a Sean Taylor or whoever, even with the horn stuff, you know, Sean Taylor, for those who don't know, my trumpet player, he's an amazing trumpet player, and he writes horn sections and everything. But I'll go in there and put a horn section together in a heartbeat, and I've never played trumpet. But I'll go in there and go, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Because you going to ask Bodhi for a package, believe that. And everything will be the way it should be on the feedback. Hands up over fists when it's clicking. You see that? Point out what you want, and it's yours.
And I'll mouth it. And just show him, yo, do it like this. And be like, oh, okay, I got you. And then he'll perform it from there. So, you know, I'll write horn sections and I'll come up with melodies and things like that. And, you know, I've never sung a note. I've never played an instrument, but I'm blessed to know music and to feel the way I feel about music. So I'm able to execute that as best as possible.
Yeah, I can tell you're a big jazz fan. I know every Sunday on Instagram, you'll
absolutely
post the jazz album you're sitting down
Sunday
with for
morning
brunch.
Jazz, absolutely.
Yeah.
Word up.
Yeah, who are some of your favorites?
Miles Davis, easily. Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Wayne Shorter, Thelonious Monk, Chick Corea.
Everyone in Miles' orbit.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, Ron Carter on bass, Clifford Brown. There's a ton, man. There's a ton. My jazz collection at the crib is kind of ridiculous. Like, it's getting bad. Like, records are overflowing and my dog is climbing over records and, like, it's getting bad. I gotta figure something out. I need to put like a shelf along the whole side of the wall in the living room, rack up. You know what I mean? I gotta talk to my DJ friends about where to get a nice shelf that's like the size of half the house.
Right.
Just put all the records up there. So I got a bunch of crates in the crib. So
yeah. And, you know, one of the first voices you hear on the album, speaking of kind of an older generation of black music, is Danny Ray, right? Is James Brown's MC introducing him on Suicide Doors.
I'd like to know, are you really ready for some super dynamite soul? And thank you, because now it's my time.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Why put that on there?
The beat came like that. That's from Mark Infinite. So Mark Infinite did Suicide Doors, and the beat came like that, you know. And when I heard it, I was like, yep. Because I had this idea, you know, after the opening record, which was All Day Always, after that record and me talking about what the album is going to sound like, I wanted to make a record that did two things simultaneously. I wanted it to be a record that continued to set up the story for the album, us wanting certain things, seeing certain things, these desires and different things like that. But I also wanted it to be a spitter. I also wanted to go crazy on a record. And I was like, you know, I really want to black out in the vein of Frisbees and the Definitive Prayer.
Label at the 2 to 8, A to get you through the day, double at it, you could cut up that and cut the move away from where they wave at. I look down, wave back, waving gets impatient, you pick and roll, I wave the horns lift, I picture the cautious, becoming beyond dip from fear of the lost sense, I'm picturing all limb that said he was awesome, retracting they talking for fear and endorsement, may seal up they coffin.
And, you know, those type of records that I've had throughout my career where I really just dumbed out, I was like, yeah, I want to do another spitter on this record. But at the same time, I can't talk about concept and a story and a plot and everything and reflection, but then have a spitter thrown in out the blue. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing as having a quote-unquote radio record thrown in out the blue.
Right, you know, feels artificial.
Yeah, it's got to make sense. So how do we have a spitter where we go crazy but still have it tie into the story? And that was Suicide Doors. So I had the concept, and if you know me, you know I'm a weirdo. I write all my song titles ahead of time. So I had the song title Suicide Doors for like 4 months before I even wrote it. And Mark Infinite, you know, super dope producer. I met Mark Infinite through Illmind. He put me on to him, and we met a year prior, and he wound up on Bauer Brothers and all that. And then he was just always sending beats, and one day he hit me, and I was like, yo, I wanted to send you something. I got something for you. I was like, all right, cool. So I'm thinking it's going to be like a batch, you know, 10 beats. It was one beat. It was one beat in the email, and it was Suicide Doors.
Wow.
And I hit him back like, yo, send the stems immediately. And I went and wrote the record the next day. I went to the studio, sat down, knocked the record out, and I sent it back to him. And he was just like, Jesus Christ, like, what is this? And, yeah, you know, and just went from there.
And so the thing about that record is it caused a tiny bit of controversy because on the song, you do something, which is a mistake a lot of rappers have made, conflating Suicide Doors and Butterfly Doors.
Yep.
You know, a lot of, you know, Kanye on down have made that mistake.
He's done it a couple times.
Yeah.
Yep.
But you did it on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it was from the point of view of a teenager who doesn't know the difference.
Absolutely.
And not a lot of people caught that. Like, you caught enough grief for it that you felt compelled to write a long explanation on your website about it.
Skyzoo's note about suicide doors, posted to Tumblr in May of this year, read in part, "On suicide doors, the idea was for the cover and hook to be an error on purpose, as the underlying theme, besides a lyrical barrage, and storyline of the song and LP, is innocent ignorance / misled youth. Coming from a generation and era where we as kids saw and wanted everything, and at times didn't even know what we were lusting for. It's the Chanel debate when the hood gets a hold of it and spends entire paychecks on it to call it Chanel, or the Moscato debate where it's a wine purely for dessert after dinner, but Drake repped it and made everyone drink it leisurely as if it were a vodka. You can find a link to the whole letter in the show notes at thecyphershow.com. Incidentally, suicide doors actually open like regular hinges, but backwards. Gullwing doors are the doors that are hinged at the roof, and butterfly doors are hinged at the front corner, so they pivot forward and up."
Yeah, I got tired of it, you know? I guess it's assuming the people may... I don't know, it's going to come off wrong. I don't want to say, I'm assuming the fans are smarter than they really are. Not that, but I guess really what they're conditioned to, I guess, is the way I want to put it. Because I don't want to come across the wrong way.
I guess if they hear five people make a mistake, why would the sixth one be any
exactly
different?
Exactly. You put it perfectly.
Yeah.
I think it's what we're conditioned to nowadays as listeners, as fans. And I say we because I'm still a listener. I'm still a fan. I think what makes anybody creative, what makes them great, is the fact that they're still a fan of whatever type of art they're creating. You know, so I'm still a fan. So as a fan and a listener, I think we've all been conditioned to expect and accept less. And it puts our frame of mind and our frame of thought in a different place. So when I did that, it's on purpose. We saw the doors lifting up and then they never came down. Because if you're a kid and you see all that going on and you driving through the neighborhood and, you know, somebody driving through the neighborhood and they got suicide doors, yo, that's crazy. Yo, boom. Regardless of what it is, yo, they got suicide doors, because that's what you hear.
Right.
It's what you hear everywhere. So even as the purchaser, the guy who's mid-20s, late-20s, who's doing whatever and got the money to afford that, he thinks that's what that is, even though it's not. It's just about having that to show off, right, having that to show validity, having that to show I made it. I'm right. Stunting and I made it. So regardless of if they know what it's called or not. So I did that on purpose. And then I put the part at the end to try to tie it home, thinking that this conversation may exist one day. So right. I'm like, well, how do we prevent that from existing?
And you sample Kanye making that mistake.
I put Kanye on one of the biggest records of his career, Can't Tell Me Nothing, which is very similar as far as the theme on some, we here to get it. And when I get it, you're not going to be able to tell me nothing. So he says it on there, let up the suicide door. So I was like, yo, let's put that at the end and let's scratch it for like a minute so people really, really get it. But it's 2015 and people are conditioned a little differently. And, you know, if suicide doors help to recondition people the right way and bring them to another way of thinking or perceiving music, then so be it. Then maybe I did my part a little bit.
And one other song that I wanted to dig into for a second was Everything's For Sale. I know you're, you know, like me, a big Jay-Z fan.
Right,
and that song plays off the line on Otis.
Yep.
Everything's for sale. Got five passports. I'm never going to jail.
They said everything's for sale. Sold us five passports and we never going to jail. So we working on the second.
But one of the things in that song is like this idea that kids may hear a line like "I got five passports, I'm never going to jail," and think that try to emulate it or think that it's real in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was interesting that you chose like one of the most hyperbolic lines of Jay-Z's career. Right? Mm-hmm. He talks about a lot of shit, but in most of it is plausible. That one is obviously just a like super exaggerated brag.
Right.
Why that line to kind of base the song on?
It's beautiful that you pointed that out. That's one of my favorite records on the album. I love that record. I love performing it. So the idea behind it, keeping in theme, you know, with being 13, 14 and whatever's around you and it influences you, just like we talked about on Suicide Doors, with Everything's For Sale, you know, as a kid, you live off the radio. All we did when we was kids was listen to Hot 97. All we did was listen to the radio, you know, all day, whether you in the crib doing homework, whether you outside playing ball and people driving by or somebody brought their radio on the step or whatever it was all we did. And whatever you hear is what you're going to be influenced by. And you hear this all day. So I thought about that line when the record came out. I love that record. Otis is an amazing record. You know, I hit that beat on the Penny Freestyle series back in 2011.
Rubber band signature, I don't do it for me. I do it for the liquor store, I'm as true as it be. Truthfully on this accord, parkour through the door. I'm just trying to get across, rosary bead rap. I'm just trying to get across, know that the feedback is all that they was living for. Living proof like I made it.
Just a great record, you know. It's hip hop, it's dirty, it's a sample. And, you know, they went crazy on it. And that's, you know, some of Jay's dopest moments that year. But when he said, you know, everything's for sale, I got 5 passports, I'm never going to jail. I said, okay, me as an adult, I get that. I understand what he's trying to say. I understand him reaching and just being a little outlandish, but at the same time, what it means and, you know, the inner workings of what all that means and being in the street with it, I understand that. But if you're 12, 13, 14, you don't understand that at all. And what do you perceive that as? So I thought, okay, well, what happens when ears that are too young get a hold of this and they can't escape it because it's a single and it's on the radio 40 times a day. So what happens then? What happens when you're 13, 14 and you hear 40 times a day, everything's for sale. I got 5 passports. I'm never going to jail. What happens when you hear that all day? Well, this is what happens. And that's how that record came about. You know, outside still smelling like where the winner's at. Look at all these empires under these fitted hats. Look at all these brilliant, genius minds under these fitted hats. Because if you're standing outside and you're doing certain things and you're living a certain life and you're a part of a certain trade that's illegal, you know, you look at the guys that are able to climb that ladder. Those guys are just as smart, if not more, than the guy running a Fortune 500 company. Because it's the same process. It's just a different product. So at the end of the day, look at all these empires under these fitted hats. Look at the grills on the cars we could be leaning on. And look at all these unmarked cars that's grilling back. The unmarked cars is the DTs, you know. Look at all these unmarked cars that's grilling back. How real is that? How real it is? All of us is just pictures of what the city did. And it just keeps going and going. We could sit here all day. But, you know, that's where that came from, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the big themes on the record also is kind of the way the city shaped your life, your
Absolutely.
Friends' lives.
Absolutely.
And even some of the harsher realities of the city, the Absolutely. Things you were talking about, so illegal things. And you take that pretty far. There's a line on the record, you say, all of us is just pictures of what the city did.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that, what you saw in Brooklyn and Queens and kind of how that
ended up just
shaping?
Growing up, 80s baby, so, you know, so the 80s and 90s, you know, and if you know anything about New York City in the late 80s and early mid-90s, you know, it was very different than what it is now. You know, there's certain areas for sure, and you can read the paper and still see certain things going on, but it was intensified. It was times 100 back then. We just grew up around that, you know. We grew up around that, and I was lucky enough to have both of my parents with me to be able to see more than just that. And that's what it really comes down to, you know. I saw that, but then I saw other things as well. You know, my parents said, nah, you're going to go to school in the city. And so I went to school with kids who lived in Tribeca and lived in the West Village and lived in the Upper East Side. I remember going to a friend's house and they had a doorman. And it blew me away
right.
at 12 years old. Like, what is a doorman? Like, you walk in somebody's crib and they have a guy in a black suit and says, you have to sign in here and we have to call upstairs. I didn't understand that, you know. But I got to understand that at 12 years old, when my friends may not have gotten to understand that until they were 20. You know, I had friends who were scared to go to Manhattan. Not because of what would happen physically, but because they didn't feel comfortable. They were more comfortable being in Brooklyn, being in Queens. They were more comfortable being in the neighborhood, and they were a little weirded out by the idea of going to Manhattan. I say all that to say we saw a lot of different things, and, you know, all of us are just pictures of what the city did, you know, simple as that. So if you blame my friends, if you blame your friends as a listener, if you blame your friends, whatever it is, you know, you can't blame them. It's really about what was put around us and what we were put in the middle of.
And you've talked about how right before you made that record, some stuff happened, you don't often go into specifics, that made you realize that not everyone in the industry kind of approached it from the same place you did in terms of morals, in terms of keeping your promises or whatever, without naming names, although you certainly can if you want.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us an idea of like what kinds of situations?
Oh, well, it's just, you know, when you get into the music industry, you know, in whatever regard, it's like any other industry. You learn how it works. You learn the moving parts, how it ticks, whatever, whatever. And when you come from a certain place, your ideas and morals may be a certain way. And when you come from where I'm from and you grow up the way I did in the era that I did, everything is mean what you say what you mean, period. No matter what. No matter what happened, you don't have to be the toughest. It doesn't make you a tough guy. Doesn't make you a killer. Doesn't make you anything. It just makes you a man or a woman. You know, it just makes you who you are. You're a stand-up individual. If you say XYZ, it's XYZ. If you do XYZ, it's XYZ. That's it. You know, it goes no further than that. And then when you get into certain industries, the music industry being one of the more, I guess, one of the industries where it happens more than a lot of others, it's a lot of the opposite. It's a lot of saying this but doing that. It's a lot of going back on your word. It's a lot of, you know, turning the corner that you weren't supposed to turn. And as someone who grew up the way I did with certain morals and values, I had to see that early on and not adapt in a way where I had to become that, but I had to adapt in a way where I'd understand what that was and say, okay, so this is how these guys are. This is how these people are. This is how this moves. All right, bet. Now I know better. Now I know how to get around this or how to do that or what to expect and not to expect of certain people. And that's all it really was. It wasn't really a specific one event, I guess. It really was just about just seeing people and things in the industry for the way that they are. And it really was realization and saying, oh, okay, I get it.
So the last time I saw you was at a Forbes taping there, yeah, where we were talking. It was you and Smoke Dizza, right, and Natalie from Forbes, who wrote an article on ghostwriting.
What's the difference between co-writing something and ghostwriting it?
For me, I think the difference is really the knowledge. Mm-hmm. Who knows what, you know, whether it's put out there. A lot of times people think, oh, they got credit, so they're not a ghostwriter. But you kind of still are if it's not common knowledge that you helped work on that record, you know?
One of the things about ghostwriting that I really wondered about was when you're writing for someone else,
right,
how aware are you of your own stylistic tics? I guess what I mean by that is if you're writing something, are you aware of stuff you do where you're like, oh, this is a dead giveaway that it's a Skyzoo rhyme. I have to not do this because I'm writing a song for someone else.
Yeah, I keep that in mind. I keep that in mind so that I can create as much separation as possible because that's the job. Mm-hmm. You know, the job is to keep the separation there so that fans aren't sitting here saying, oh, I know Skyzoo wrote this. So, you know, it's great. I love to hear such and such spit it, but I know Sky wrote this. That's when you're not doing your job, you know. Now, of course, there's some fans who are so in tune with the music and they're such diehard fans that they're going to be able to say, I could tell he wrote this. I could tell this person wrote that. Just because they've been there since day one and they got every project and they know every line bar, which is cool. That's dope, you know, but the idea is definitely to create as much separation as possible. So
what are some traits of your writing that you, right, would try and take out?
Well, obviously a lot of double and triple entendres. Certain words I may use as far as New York slang, you know, there are certain words that I don't use in my music that I use in other people's music because they use it. You know, if you know, mm-hmm, my music, you know, I never use the N-word.
Right.
But if I'm ghostwriting for somebody, you may hear it 30, 40 times because I'm not writing for me. I'm writing for them. The same way you take a Will Smith. Will Smith was always against, like, really cursing. Like, he doesn't really curse a lot in his everyday life. He wouldn't curse in his music. But in a movie, if he's in Bad Boys, he's cursing his brains out.
Right.
Because he's not being himself. He's being Mike Lowry, you know?
Yeah.
So it's the same thing where if I'm being me, I'm being Skyzoo, when I'm writing my music, you won't hear me utter the N-word at all. But if I'm writing for such and such, and they use it in all of their music before I got to the table, if they would have suddenly stopped now, it's like, what are we doing?
Right.
So I'm not going to be like, well, I could write for you, but I'm not going to put that word there. So you might have to find. Nah, I'm going to use it because I'm not writing for me. I'm not speaking my voice. I'm speaking your voice. So I'm going to adapt to you and keep you in being who you are and in the situations that you're in and keep the lineage that you've created. I'm going to keep that there. And I'm just here to add my influence and enhance it and put my spin on it as far as whatever you brought me to the table to do.
So. Have you reached a point now, because you've been around that world, where you can kind of tell if you hear a record that it wasn't written by the artist?
1,000%.
Yeah?
1,000%. Even before my first ghostwriting gig, I guess just being an MC and being a fan at the same time, I've heard records and been like, ah, so-and-so wrote that. So-and-so wrote that. Even if they didn't get the credit for it, I've heard records and been like, yep, that's so-and-so.
What are some of the clues?
Everything that you said that I don't do as a ghostwriter, everything that we talked about me not doing, mm-hmm. are things that, you know, other writers make the mistake of doing.
Of sounding putting like their
them.
Own
Yeah,
their
sounding
own
like them. So
stuff.
You could hear somebody spit a verse or whatever, and it's like, oh, that sounds just like so-and-so. And so-and-so runs with them, and he signed to the label. And okay, one and one makes two. You right. know what I mean? So you're able to put that together. And then you find out later, yeah, so-and-so put that down. So-and-so wrote that. And it's like, yep, I knew it.
Right. I remember, to my ear, the most extreme example of that, I actually talked to Pharoah Monch about it, was the record he wrote for Diddy, where right. it literally sounded like a right. Pharoah reference vocal, his inflections right. and all that. Right. Yeah.
Assemble my own team to say fuck FEMA in case there's another Katrina. You laughed at the past. Said I was a dreamer, but it's back to the future. Sold out arenas, we take them to the cleaners. Calm your nerves. This is the man who provided more jobs for blacks than armed services.
Let's go.
Cut them corners.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's different, you know. So with me as a writer, my job is to make you sound like you. Just give you the words to fill in the blanks and sound greater than you've ever sounded lyrically, because I'm a lyricist and all that. But it's to keep you sounding like you. So if I write a record for you, I don't want you to sound like me, because then I could have just spit that myself. I want you to sound like you. I want it to be like, yo, oh man, Sky wrote for Sean. Yo, man, I didn't even know. I just thought Sean had these great rhymes all of a sudden. You know what I mean? It sounds just like Sean on the podcast. You know, like that's the goal. You know what I mean?
I should say you ghostwrote all my questions for today. So.
I wish I could, because your questions are nuts, man. You're such an encyclopedia, man. It's very awe-inspiring indeed.
Well, thank you. So on a couple songs I noticed while re-listening to some of your more recent stuff, the Reasonable Doubt and the Bauer Brothers Project, you make references to being raised a Jehovah's Witness.
Right.
And turn Cain, trying to save her remains. Raised as a J-Dub, and so the way I was laid was on a stake, not a cross, blood stains on the flowers. Do believe as a lesson learned for the less inclined. Raised as a Jehovah's Witness, but might never get inside the evils.
Is that true?
Yeah.
What was that like? I feel like that's a religion that's often like misunderstood, and people
Absolutely.
Just know like one or two things, or think
Absolutely.
They know one or two things. Like, oh, you don't celebrate birthdays, and that's
right,
kind
right.
of like the end of it.
Yeah, it's looked at a certain way. I was raised partially that way. I wasn't raised that way from birth and 100% and never had a birthday. And I'm all about my birthday. Christmas is my favorite holiday, you know, and my family and everyone knows that. I was raised with those holidays, but what happened was, my pops got married when I was, I want to say 11, 12. He got married. So I have stepmoms who was like a mother as well. So, you know, I always grew up saying I had three parents. I got my pops and my two moms, because, you know, my stepmoms loves me just as much as my moms and does just as much. It is no different. We don't even really use the word step, you know. So it's a really, really dope situation that I'm blessed to have. So she grew up as a witness. And when her and my pops got married, she brought all that with her. And it actually changed my pops for the better, because my pops, if you know me personally, outside of music, you know, my pops was a goon. He ran around Brooklyn going crazy, and, you know, he was who he was and still is. But when he got married, it changed him for the better, and now he is more religious, and, you know, he's a diehard, dedicated J-Dub and all that. You know, he totally changed his life for the better, which is great. So all of that was brought in when I was about 12. So we started going to the hall and started getting into it. I never knocked on a door a day in my life, but I don't knock anybody who does. And I know what all that's about, mm-hmm. you know. So, you know, nobody can ever say, oh, Scott knocked on my door. No, I didn't. You know what I mean? But if I did, so what? If that was a choice I made, then so be it. You know, right. That's not to knock it. It's just before anybody starts to try to act stupid. Mm-hmm. You know, but I say all that to say I'm not, you know, I haven't, you know, gone fully in. I'm not, you know, I'm definitely a J-Dub, but that's how I was brought up for a large portion of my life, as well as all the other stuff that we had before that, birthdays and Christmas. So I have a lot of different sides as far as I understand this, I understand that, I understand all these different religions and spiritual walkings and ways of life that I adapt to. And it just so happens that what I learned about witnesses is a lot of stuff that I agree with. You know, when I was old enough, as far as high school and all that, to really form the opinion of, okay, well, this is how the world works. This is how these things are looked at. This is how that's looked at. You know what? I kind of agree with what J-Dubs do a little more than what Baptists do, or a little more than what whoever does, you know? So that's where I'm at. So that's why I say stuff like, brought up as a J-Dub and raised as a witness like Jill Scott and the Jacksons, but born a day before Christmas, so shit, I'm probably backwards.
I'm living out of a rapper, gold ones to be honest, with big XLs all over them if you jack it.
That's why I say all that type of stuff, because I do agree with ways that they walk in life a little more than the other things that I've seen and experienced religious-wise. So I do go to the hall, you know, when I'm home, if I'm not on tour, or, you know, if I'm not tied up or whatever, and I have an open Sunday to go serve, and if I had to pick one place to go to, whether it was a Baptist church and, you know, Floyd Flake or whether, you know, whatever it is, you know, I am going to the hall instead, mm-hmm. you know, and that's just a choice that I make. It doesn't mean that that's what it's going to be until the day I'm gone or whatever it is, but I do believe in that more than I believe in anything else as far as spiritual walks of life. But man, I'm nowhere near being 100% that guy, because I still got a lot that I do and I still got a lot of wrongs to me and I'm not perfect and I still got a lot going on. So I don't even have the privilege of being able to say I'm 100% hardcore J-Dub and I walk that way of life, because that's a serious path and dedication to take. And I'm not ready and I don't deserve the privilege of being able to say that yet. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I just do what I do.
Yeah. And, you know, moving from one Jehovah to another, you had that Ode to Reasonable Doubt
right.
record, which is fantastic. Thank you. Nine songs at EP right. length tribute to Reasonable Doubt. That's wonderful. And it seems like that album is in a lot of ways about how Reasonable Doubt affected you.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like the right. like the impact that album left on you, left on people around you.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Looking back yeah. on it now, what impact did Reasonable Doubt have on you, like artistically and otherwise?
Right. Well, yeah, I'll start with that. I feel like it's a two-pronged question. I'll start with that. 96, summer 96, school had just ended, getting ready to go into ninth grade, and Reasonable Doubt came out. Indie label, Priority, Freeze Records, and, you know, Jay was on the radio, of course, video, of course, but it wasn't what it is now. He's an indie artist. It was like me, in a sense. He just had more startup money, you know? It was an indie label, you know? And a week later, Nas, It Was Written came out. At this point, Nas is one of the biggest rappers out, you know? If I Ruled the World is huge. Classic album just came out, but he didn't sell the records everyone thought, but it was critically acclaimed, and it was on a major, so he had the visibility. Now it's really time to swing for the fences, track masses behind. So It Was Written was just, it took over. You know, it took over from Reasonable Doubt. Anybody telling you otherwise is lying. That summer was about It Was Written. But Reasonable Doubt was a phenomenal, phenomenal album. It's just that It Was Written was in the way at the moment. Reasonable Doubt is the album everybody goes back to. But if you're from Brooklyn, you knew what Reasonable Doubt was immediately. You know what I mean? So, you know, you juggled both. If you was from anywhere else in the world, it was about It Was Written. But if you was from Brooklyn, you just juggled both albums at the same time. And Reasonable Doubt was all of these stories and ideas where at the time I was really into the album, but I didn't understand it as much right away because I was not even in ninth grade yet. I was approaching ninth grade. So it was the same era that I speak about on Music for My Friends, 13, 14 years old. Whereas It Was Written, I understood a little more because it was just straight to the point lyricism. And it was ridiculous, superb lyricism, but it was a little more straight to the point. Whereas Reasonable Doubt was a lot of hidden meanings, code talk, because he was still in the street or he was just getting out of the street. He was still wiping his shoes off because they were still dirty from the street. Yeah. You know, so it was a lot of codes and a lot of underhand and a lot of doubles and triples, stuff that I, you know, I'm all about now. You know, mm-hmm. that stuff raised me. But Reasonable Doubt, I mean, fantastic, fantastic album. But, you know, like he even says himself, speaking in code.
Residential suites, my residential for the weekend. Confidentially speaking in code since I sent you beacon.
And it's layering, and it's all these other stories that you may not have known about if you wasn't in the game. And it came out at a time where that wasn't the norm, and it was a lot of sample stuff. It was just all these different things that made it more about the layers and peeling it all back. And for me, it helped raise me as a writer, as an MC, the same way Illmatic and It Was Written did, the same way Ready to Die did, and the same way Only Built for Cuban Links and Liquid Swords, you know, all those albums raised me as a writer and as a lyricist and as an MC. But Reasonable Doubt specifically, it was about you know, not too far away. It was about Mossy, which was like a 15-minute drive. You know, it was about not too far away, and it was about being faced with these adversities and what road you choose to overcome them, you know, and taking that leap of faith, whether right or wrong. And,
right.
And, you know, that album, you know, continued to mean the world to me. And then moving forward, when it came to my interpretation of it, when it came to Older Reasonable Doubt, the way that came about, so 2011, Elzai drops Elmatic.
Right, which was phenomenal.
Dead bodies in Lake Michigan to shake fishermen. Pimps turning the pastures to fake. Bishops in the churches and prophets determine off what you purchase or who you merchant. A week ago, ducking from searches and police.
Right, where he redid Elmatic and, you know, he had a live band and everything, Will Sessions, and it was great. So about 2 weeks after it comes out, a fan tweets, Elzai just redid Elmatic. Can we get Sky Zoo to redo Reasonable Doubt? He's the only one who can handle that. So I retweeted it and wrote LOL next to it. I thought it was really funny and cool, and it was an honor for someone to say that. Man, that retweet, wildfire. People went nuts. Yo, is this real? Yo, you're going to do it? Yo. I was, whoa, slow down. Like, I didn't, wait a minute. I just dropped Great Debater a couple weeks ago. Hold on. Like, you know what I mean? Like, whoa. I have no intention on redoing that album. I didn't live that life in that capacity at all. I have no intention on redoing that. You know, the thing with Illmatic, Nas talked about his neighborhood. Nas talked about what was going on around him in his neighborhood. Queensbridge, right. Sitting on the bench, walking through the lobby. Jay talked about we was out of town and these kids was in the hotel and we stuck them up because they was trying to one-up us.
My guess is you got work at the hotel. I take care of that. You'll soon see. Now, please, give me the room key. You're twitching. Don't do that. You're making me nervous. My crew, well, they do pack. Them dudes is murderers. So please, would you put your hand back in sight? They don't like to see me nervous. You can understand that, right? You draw, better be Picasso. You know the best. Because if this is not so, God bless.
And then we was doing this, and I'm dealing with fiends. And, you know, it's a little, I don't want to say easier at all, but it's a little more relatable to be able to just write about your neighborhood from your point of view. But to write about these stories dealing with, you know, going to the Heights and dealing with Poppy and then, you know, going to the two hotel town, you know, and dealing with the guy at the Holiday Inn in the room and locking the door and, you know, pulling out hammers. And it's a little different, you know what I mean, as far as how to rewrite that.
Yeah.
So I was like, whoa. Like, nah, I had no intention or idea of doing that. So, nah, we're cool. But it just kept coming up. And for 2 years straight, it kept coming up. And I would do interviews with guys like you and, you know, different media outlets. And, yo, man, when are you going to do it? Is it happening? Is it happening? And it just kept going and kept going. So one day I said, you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. I said, but if I do it, it got to be different. You know, sonically, it has to be different. The first thing that comes to mind is a live band because I love live instrumentation. And that's just the easiest way to take it over the top. But I didn't want to do that because Elzai just did that. So I was like, I'm not going to redo a classic debut album like he did and take the same approach. I'm not going to do that. I'm also not going to just rhyme over the instrumentals because anybody who goes on YouTube can do that. They can just go on YouTube, grab all the instrumentals, flip them, and go for it. So how can I do this a different way? Then Illmind, ironically, puts me onto another producer, same way he did Mark Infinite, puts me onto a producer by the name of Ant-Man Wonder. So we go to Ant-Man SoundCloud. Turns out he's a producer-composer from Philly, creates original compositions that sound like samples, gives them an old school 70s Stevie Wonder sound. It sounds like something you dug up in a crate at A1, but it's original. Well, 100% he created every note himself. And he can also recreate samples and make them sound like an orchestra. And then he brings in an orchestra. He does all these beautiful things musically. And we go to his SoundCloud page, and I'm already blown away. And then he has a record on there where he flipped Bring It On. With, you know, Jay-Z, Jazzo, Sauce Money.
Yeah.
And the way he flipped that, I said, this is how we do this album. If he's in.
Yeah.
Let's go. I'm down.
And you gave him equal billing on the project.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was like a collabo EP. So absolutely. You know, he produced the entire thing himself. I DM'd him on Twitter. Hit me right back. Yo, I've been a fan. So dope to hear from you. I would love to work. Get on the phone. I said, man, I got this idea. I've had this idea for a while. I go to your SoundCloud. You made this one beat. Can you do the rest of them. He goes, man, I already got four more done. I was redoing this project just for myself. He said, I already had four or five of these beats done from like a year ago. This is just something I was messing around with. I was toying with the idea of putting out a recreation orchestral version of that album, instrumental, and just throwing it out. I said, dude, let's go. Send me the stems, let's go. And we started. And I wrote that album or EP or whatever in about 3 weeks. I wrote that over the course of about 3 weeks. Yeah, I write fast. If you know me, you know I write fast.
Yeah.
Especially like EPs and quick projects. You know, like me and Torre did Bauer Brothers in about a month and a half. You know, I did Great Debater in a month. You know, anything like that is quick. Because I write quick. I write 16 to 20 minutes. I can write a song in an hour. Like, I write kind of fast. So we did that in about 3 weeks.
Wow. But that one, you're kind of under unusual constraints when writing it, because it has to be the flows, the rhythms have to be similar.
Absolutely.
You have to throw in a line that's either a direct quote or has a couple words from the actual line every so often, so people don't lose the thread.
Shopping sprees, copping three, deuce fever, IS's, fully loaded, yes, bouncing in the Lex Luger, tire smoke like Buddha, 50 G's to the crap shooter, niggas can't fade me, chrome stocks beaming, through my peripheral, I see you scheming.
Shopping sprees, dropping G's on the shoes your girl choose, like fuckers there to lose, bouncing in a pine Rover, stunt and drive slower. Day one's over my shoulder. No one could fade me. Chrome stocks gleaming. Grown man, I'm good on the features.
Yeah.
How is that to do?
You're wearing a lot of cuffs, like you said. You know, there's all these constraints. And that makes it a little more challenging. But if you're really an MC and you're really about the creative process, it's a good challenge. It's like, yeah, word up. Oh, we got to play Kevin Durant tonight. Word up. It's a challenge. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's a good challenge. It's something that you welcome if you're really about the craft and the art and the sport of it all. So I spent maybe a month before I started. I spent maybe a month really just listening to Reasonable Doubt every day, really just remembering why I loved it so much, but really the intricacies of it. We picked certain records that felt like they made sense orchestral-wise. You know, I didn't want to do every record. I didn't want to do all 14 records.
Sure.
I felt like, you know, records like Cashmere Thoughts and Ain't No, you know, the Foxy Brown joint, they were great records, but if you put an orchestra vibe to them, they wouldn't sound as dope because the beats were really underproduced and you know, more simplified, which is beautiful. You know, that's not a knock at all. You know, sometimes underproducing is amazing. So those records, certain records like that, it made sense not to do them. You know, Friend or Foe, it made sense not to do those records sonically.
Right.
So we only did 9 records out of 14. We picked the 9 that made the most sense sonically, where we could go as far as the production, as far as the lyricism and my stories. And also, the idea behind the project wasn't to redo what Jay did. It wasn't to say, okay, Jay talked about, you know, going out of town and flipping birds, so I'm going to talk about going out of town, flipping birds, and just make it as lyrical
as I can. Set in 2015 or whatever.
Yeah, I wasn't going to do that. You know, the idea was to take me as Skylar, not as Sean, but as Skylar, and what I've experienced and what I know and what I've been through and my frame of mind, how would I react if put in certain situations like him? You know, you take like a record like Regrets. Regrets is my favorite Jay-Z song ever. It's a record that most people overlook, they forget about. Regrets is my favorite Jay-Z record ever. Regrets and Coming of Age, neck and neck, but really Regrets. You take a record like that, he has regrets about certain things in his life as far as, you know, living with regrets, hustling and doing whatever and dealing with this, that, and the third.
This time they got us on tape, exchanging dope for dollars. Make me wanna holler back at the crib of the sauna. Praying my people bailed out like Time Warner. A waiting call from his kin, not the coroner. Phone in my hand, nervous, confined to a corner. Beads of sweat, second thoughts on my mind. How can I ease the stress and learn to live with these regrets? Stress,
giving a shit. Fuck. And I put that into the regrets that I've had in my life and how to live with those regrets of being forced with those decisions and choosing yes or no. And when you do, what's the outcome? And you have to live with the fact that you said no to doing that or you said yes to doing this. So I put my spin on it and my take.
I'm in a place where my demise could be memories from the top or memories of a spot where my memories should have popped. And with that, remember me as the centerpiece at the top. How I inspired your faves, it's bittersweet when they drop. And with that, if I should leave and then team with they kind, how can I ease the stress and learn to live with these regrets this time? Giving this shit up.
So it's really about my interpretation. You look at the evils, Jay talked about growing up and, you know, hustling with his friends and how that went bad.
Yeah. We used to fight for building blocks. Now we fight for blocks with builders that make a killing. The closest of friends when we first started, but grew apart as the money grew. Soon grew black hearted. Thinking back when we first learned to use rubbers, he never learned. So in turn, I'm kidnapping his baby's mother. My hand
And I talked about having my friends with me no matter what I did or didn't do, and how that may have separated us or brought us together or divided us or brought us back together.
Yeah, we all wanted the spotlight, and even if we innocent, we scared of the cop lights. The irony, right? We saw the same things vying for life. It was either find a Dominican or find us a mic. Thinking back when we first learned to make a decision, and the thought of having to live with that as long as we living. It was like a hand around my collar, saying to breathe, and every time I'd attempt, it would clinch until I gave in.
So it was just my spin in my life, my real life as far as that. And I think that's why everybody took to the project, aside from the fact that production-wise, Ant-Man won that absolutely killed it, besides the fact that I still did what I do lyrically, so you didn't lose any lyricism or whatever it was. It wasn't me trying to be him. It was me putting my spin on those same scenarios and what would I do and how would I react as myself, not as somebody trying to be Jay. And I think that's why everybody took to it so much.
Yeah. You know, there's something I wanted to talk to you about celebrity for a second, because, you know, you're in show business, you know, and, yeah. and to some degree, you're trying to gain success as an artist. And one of the things that go along with that in our culture is a certain amount of celebrity
right.
as you gain success as a rapper.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a different, I think, point of view on that than most people, whether it's because of the people you're around writing or just people mm-hmm. in the industry you've become friendly with, or because of, you know, people you've been exposed to in your personal life and right. in the sports world,
right.
you've seen stars and even superstars
yeah.
Close up a lot.
Yeah.
And you've seen, you know, not just like in a situation like this where it's an interview or whatever, but, right. or in the studio, but like how they live
right.
and, you know, presumably the ups and downs of that. I was just curious, like how that affects what you're trying to do as an artist. Do you think like seeing celebrities kind of close up has right. changed your career goals at all?
I don't know if it's changed them in a way where it's diverted me from it or made me turn the corner, but I think it's just shown me what to expect. It's like, okay, if you really want this, know that this comes with it. Or if you really want this, know to handle it this way. You know to go about it this way instead of that way. And I think that's why I guess my media training or PR training, so to speak, even though I've never had it, has always seemed like, dag, like who did his, you know, who trained him how to deal with the media and how to deal with fans and how to deal with nobody. It's just I was observant and able to be around certain situations and learn from it and be a sponge. Okay, these guys react like this. They shouldn't react like that. In this situation, they should react like this. How do I know that? Because I've been around XYZ and saw how it went bad, saw how it went good, you know, so I don't think it's changed what I want. It's just made me more cognizant of what to expect, what comes with everything, how to deal with everything, and just taking it from there. And it is a blessing, you know, being able, like you mentioned, sports figures and things, being able to be around some of the biggest sports figures in the world where it'll never get any bigger, being able to really spend time with these people in their homes, you know, on a daily basis, like family, you know, a blessing, because I'm able to look at, okay, this is how being a rapper looks like, but this is what it's really like when everybody likes right. you. It's right. kind of like when Chris Rock was on Real Husbands of Hollywood with Kevin Hart, and he was like, I'm famous. You black people famous.
Kev, what you got to understand is I'm actually famous. You're more black famous.
After having this conversation with you, I see why everybody hates Chris.
Everybody hates Chris. See, everybody knows me because of all the stuff I did, like everybody hates Chris. If Kevin had a show, it'd be called Nobody Knows Kevin. This is a little...
You know what I mean? It's kind of the same thing, you know, not to make it a race thing, but it's like when he was like, I host the Oscars. You host the Hip Hop Awards. You know what I mean? It's the same thing. It's like, this is what it's like being a top rapper. This is what it's like when you are known all over the world, no matter what race, gender, economic standing, class, background, because of sports. Because sports is the one thing that brings everybody together. You could be on the block doing whatever and be just as much of a Yankee fan as the guy who works stock exchange, corporate America, or as the guy who grew up in Bensonhurst, and that, and you guys are all sitting there wearing a gray bottom Yankee fitted at Yankee Stadium, cheering them on, hoping it goes right, you know, or the Knicks or whatever it is. So, like, sports is the one thing that brings us all together, no matter. You could be sitting next to a guy who would be your enemy in any other surrounding, but for the next 48 minutes, it's Melomania and you want it to go right. You know what I mean? So it's when you see that, it's totally different from hanging out with a popular rapper at the moment. Mm-hmm. It's totally different, you know, and it's a privilege to be able to learn from those experiences.
Yeah. On a slightly more serious note, you know, we had Sean Price pass away not long ago. And, you know, I saw you around that time at his RIP pass.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you guys were very close. You had toured a lot together. Collaborated and presumably were, you know, close in personal ways. I don't know. I mean, I guess what was that period like when you kind of found out and, you know, that this huge member of your community had passed away so suddenly?
It was rough. As rough as I knew it would be after finding out, it was rougher than I thought. It hit me rougher than I thought it would. And that's not to say it didn't deserve to hit me rough, because absolutely, I mean, you know, P was a super close friend and that was my man, but I knew it was going to be rough, but it was really rough. You know what I mean? It was like, wow, like, holy shit, like, that happened? You know what I mean? It was one of those for a long time. It's still kind of like, it's like, nah, what? Like, that happened? You know, like, it really, really, really messed with me, man. I found out on the set of a video. I was shooting a video for Playing Favorites all day, and we had like 11 a.m. start time. And so I was on set, and I had, you know, some extras in the video and everything. And after shooting for about an hour, hour and a half, we all took a break, change the scene, do this, that, whatever. And I turned the phone on. I had the phone turned off so I could work. Turned the phone on, and I lit up 20, 30 text messages. And everybody's saying the same thing. And I'm like, what? Like, and the first person I called was Torre, you know, because we had the same relationship with him. We met him around the same time. And he looked at us the same way. The way he looked at me was how he looked at Tor, like little brothers and MCs and lyricists. So it was the same relationship, you know, a lot of three-way emails and texts. And, you know, it was us. It was the three of us. So first person I called, I had always messaged, but I called Tor first. I was like, dude, what? He picked up hello. I was like, dude, what? What the fuck just happened? And he was like, I can't, yo. He was like, I can't even cope today, man. Like, I don't even know what to do. I was like, yo, is this for real? He was like, I don't even know what to do, man. Like, I can't even be on the phone. I don't know what to do, B. I was like, dude, what the hell is going on? And then I called Drew High and I called the crib and, you know, I couldn't catch anybody because there was so much going on. But I was just broken, you know. And then you go through the day, and you're working, and it's the shock value, so it's not in yet. It's not hitting in yet, you know, and you go through the deal, and, you know, then it becomes a thing on the radio, and, you know, everybody's doing tributes, which is great, and it becomes a Twitter thing. You can't get away from it on Twitter and Instagram and see people showing love. And it hit at the funeral. It hit at the funeral when I went to the wake, pardon me. It hit at the wake. Seeing it there, seeing everybody there, and seeing him there, and it hit hard at the wake. I went outside, I cried, and I'm not a crier, man. I'm a Capricorn. If you know anything about Capricorns, we don't really have a lot of emotion. The little bit of emotion we do have, we don't show it, you know. So we're kind of just if we win the lotto, we got the same face as if we failed a test, you know. Like that's just Capricorn nature. We don't really let stuff bother us, whatever, whatever, and. So it takes a lot for us to cry or be bothered. And I went outside and I just cried. I think it was the first time I cried since Dilla died. Literally, that's no exaggeration. I think it was the first time I cried since Dilla died. So it was like Jerry Seinfeld. I was on like a 9-year, you know, no crying streak. You know, it was the first time since Dilla died. But I went outside and cried a little bit, drunk a lot of Hennessy. And then, you know, I cried again at the memorial concert at SOBs. And that was bad. When I cried there, that was bad. Like, I was walking through the crowd, streaming, like, shaking, because me and Torre had just rocked. And Torre got a little shooken up on stage, and, you know, he held it together, and I was holding it together. And to look and see Bernadette standing at the front of the stage, bawling. I was done. I held it together during the performance. I got off stage and she just reached out and grabbed me and hugged me. I was done. It just flowed. You know?
The second you didn't have to be together anymore.
Yeah. And she brought it out of me, man. And, you know, she brought it out of me. And I guess I needed to let it go and get that out. The crazy thing is, when it happened, I had dreams about Sean for like 5-6 nights. Like, it was just every night he was in my dream. You know, every night it was us in the studio, us bugging out. It was just dreams about, oh, hanging out here and doing this. And I was talking to Tor, and he was like, yo, dude, me too. He was like, yo, every night. Like, I've had dreams about Sean every single night from Saturday on, from the day it happened on. And we came to the realization, was like, yo, he's messing with us, man. Like, he's up there messing, he's fucking with us.
In true Sean Price fashion.
Yeah, he's up there fucking with us, man. Like, he's up there mushing us in the head. You know what I mean? He's like, aha, look at y'all, aha. You know, like, he's up there fucking with us, man. And, you know, it made us laugh. You know, we talked about it at the wake. I was like, yo, man, every night. He was like, son, me too. He's like, yo, he's definitely up there fucking with us, man. He's up there having a last laugh, joking on us, as he would, you know. Sure. It was like him cracking a joke about being on tour, you know. So, you know, but, yeah, miss him terribly, man. But the music lives forever, you know. It happened a couple times this year, man. Chinks dying was rough. You know, I was cool with Chinks. I was real cool with him and just the whole squad up. You know, I came up with Stack Bundles and them back in the day as teenagers.
Raekwon Stack Bundles Elliott was a rapper from Far Rockaway, Queens, who was on the verge of stardom when he was murdered in the lobby of his building in 2007. In our first interview with Sky on episode 18, he speaks in depth on his relationship with Stack. As Sky makes clear later in this interview, Stack and rapper Lionel Chinks Pickens, who was murdered this past May, were part of the same Riot Squad crew when they were first starting out. Stack's older brother recently speculated to the New York Daily News that the two murders, both unsolved, may be connected.
Just to see all that happen again, and I felt like I was just with him right before that, a couple months, whatever it was, and, you know, it's just, it's crazy, man. It's funny, on the album, you know, Luxury was the single, and I was talking about putting Chinks on the remix. That was a conversation, you know, and I'm real cool with his manager, my man Halim. I knew him even before that. Well, he's not his manager. He was one of his managers, kind of product managers and tour, you know, helping behind the scenes put the whole thing together. Wasn't his day-to-day manager. I don't want to be incorrect. But very instrumental behind the scenes with him, real close to him. And me and Halim go way back to, like, Queens days, 2000, 2001. And I had already spoke to Ha about it. I was like, yeah, I'm out to hit Chinks. He was like, yeah, hit him. You know, he was like, yo, he just changed the number. So here go the new number. Hit him. You know, I already let him know you're going to reach out. I was like, yeah, I ain't speak to Chinks in a little while, you know, since Stack Day and this and that or whatever. So, yeah, you know, I'm going to hit him up, whatever. And he was like, yeah, you know, definitely that'll be dope. Like that's right up his alley. So, you know, the idea was pulling him on a Luxury remix and maybe another, you know, one or two artists thinking of some people who made sense. And then, you know, that happened. And it, you know, it was just a wild time.
I hadn't realized that Chinks and Stack were friends.
Oh, yeah. Stack put Chinks on. That's all squad up. That's all Riot Squad. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, like it was Stack, Chinks, Core 2 Gs, and Bino. You know, that was the four of them. That was Riot Squad. You know, when Chinks was locked up, there's a million pictures of Stack wearing free Chinks t-shirts. A million. If you Google image Stack Bundles, like the first picture that comes up is him in a free Chinks Drugs t-shirt. Like, that was, you know, he put him on, you know. Wow. So when you listen to Chinks' album, you know, how it opens, one of the first records is with Stack, and he says on a little skit, like, you know, Stack put me on, so I'm Riot Squad before anything. Before Coke Boys, before anything, I'm Riot Squad. You know, like, yeah, Stack put him on. That's all Far Rockaway stuff. That's all,
right,
you know, Edgemere, Redfern stuff and all that, you know. So, yeah, that he put him on.
All right, thanks, Sky.
Yeah.
It's always a joy to talk to Sky Zoo, and our conversations go to interesting and unusual places. Whether it's about becoming a great freestyler, how to spot a ghost-written song, or even how he dealt with the sudden passing of a close friend, Sky Zoo always brings something new and unexpected to the table. Not everyone grew up in Bed-Stuy down the street from Biggie, but everyone has at some point been a 13-year-old struggling to understand the world. That's why Music for My Friends is such a standout record, and why hearing Sky Zoo talk about it feels so honest. The album is about a stage of life that everyone can relate to, and I'm really happy to be able to bring you our discussion. Join us next week when we talk to the great producer Jake One. We'll discuss how he moved from working with local artists in his hometown of Seattle to making beats for 50 Cent and G-Unit, Freeway, Brother Ali, T.I., and countless others. We also get deep into the art of sampling, producer ethics, and more. As I mentioned at the top, make sure you subscribe on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, give us a rating or a review. If you want to take an extra step to support the show, you can make a donation at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Even a couple bucks a month will go a long way. You can find us everywhere on social media at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. More information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
If he's in Bad Boys, he's cursing his brains out.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
He's the only one who can handle that.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
It's a really, really dope situation, and I'm blessed to have.
Special thanks to our top Patreon supporter, Vikram.
Then maybe I did my part a little bit.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Proud to be from here. You're proud to be a part of it, whether you make it out or not. And if you do make it out, you better never forget it. It's all about where you're from.